characters whose dialogue she's speaking. Minka's tale reminds me of Grimm, of Isak Dinesen, of Hans Christian Andersen, of the time when fairy tales were not diluted with Disney princesses and dancing animals, but were dark and bloody and dangerous. In those old tomes, love took a toll, and happy endings came at a cost. There's a lesson in that, and it's tugging at me. But I'm distracted, held spellbound by the pulse in Sage's throat that beats a little faster the first time Anya and Alex, the most unlikely of couples, meet.
"Nobody,"
Sage reads,
"who looks at a shard of flint lying beneath a rock ledge, or who finds a splintered log by the side of the road, would ever find magic in their solitude. But in the right circumstances, if you bring them together, you can start a fire that consumes the world."
We become the Upiora in the story, awake all night. The sun is already crawling over the horizon when Sage reaches the part where Alex falls into the trap the soldiers have set. He's jailed and scheduled to be tortured to death, unless he can convince Anya to kill him first, out of mercy. Suddenly Sage closes the book.
"You can't just stop there,"
I protest.
"I have to. That's all she wrote."
Her hair is a mess. The circles under her eyes are so dark it looks like she's fielded a punch. "Minka knew what happened," I say decisively, "even if she chose not to tell the rest of us."
I was going to ask her why she never finished it, but then I didn't. And now I can't.
Sage looks at me, her heart in her eyes.
"How do you think it ends?"
I tuck Sage's hair behind her ear. "Like this," I say, and I kiss the ridged trail of her scar. She sucks in her breath, but she doesn't pull away. I kiss the corner of her eye where the skin pulls down because of a graft. I kiss the smooth silver flecks on her cheek that remind me of falling stars. And then I kiss her mouth. At first, I hold her in my arms like something fragile. I have to exercise every fiber of my body not to crush her tighter against me. I've never felt like this about a woman, like I need to consume her. "Think of baseball," I tell myself, but I know nothing of value about baseball. So I start silently listing the justices of the Supreme Court just so that I don't scare her off by moving too fast. But Sage, thank God, winds her arms around my neck and presses herself flush against me. Her fingers comb through my hair. Her breath fills me. She tastes of lemon and cinnamon. She smells of coconut lotion and lazy sunsets. She is a live wire, and everywhere she touches me, I burn. When she grinds her hips against mine, I surrender. With her legs wrapped around me and her dress tangled around her waist, I carry her into the bedroom and lay her down on the crisp sheets. She pulls me over her body like an eclipse of the sun, and my last conscious thought is that there could not possibly be a better finale to this story. In the cocoon of the room, created by blackout shades, we are caught in a bubble of time. Sometimes I wake up holding Sage. Sometimes she wakes up holding me. Sometimes all I can hear is her heartbeat. Sometimes her voice wraps me as tightly as the tangled sheets.
"It was my fault," she says at one point. "It was after graduation, and my mother and I, we'd packed up the car to go home. It was so full she couldn't see out the back windows, so I told her I'd drive. It was a beautiful day. That made it even worse. There was no rain, no snow, nothing else to blame it on. We were on the highway. I was trying to pass a truck, but I didn't see the car in the other lane, so I swerved. And then..." A shudder runs down her spine. "She didn't die, not right away. She had surgery, and then she got an infection, and her body started to shut down. Pepper and Saffron, they said it was an accident. But I know deep down they still blame me. and my mother did too. I hold her tightly. I'm sure that's not true. When she was in the hospital, Sage says, when she was dying, she told me, I forgive you. There's no reason to forgive someone unless you know they've done something wrong. Sometimes bad things just happen, I say. I brush my thumb over her cheek, tracing the topographical rise and valley of her scars. She catches my hand, brings it to her mouth, kisses it. And sometimes, good things do. I have 1,000 excuses. It was the red wine, the white, the stress of the day, the stress of the job, the way her black dress hugged her curves, the fact that we were lonely slash horny slash sublimating grief. Freud would have plenty to say about my indiscretion. So would my boss. What I've done, taking advantage of a woman who was instrumental in an open HRSP case, one who had attended a funeral hours before, is unconscionable. Worse, I'd do it all over again. Eva the dog is giving me the evil eye, and why shouldn't she? She witnessed the whole sordid, intense, amazing affair. Sage is still asleep in the bedroom. Because I don't trust myself to be near her, I'm out here on the couch in my boxers and t-shirt, poring over Rainer Hartmann's file with every ounce of Jewish guilt I can muster. I can't undo what I did last night to take advantage of Sage, but I can damn well figure out a way to make sure this case doesn't get ruined in the process. Hi. When I turn around, there she is wearing my white button-down shirt. It almost covers her. Almost. I stand up, torn between grabbing her and dragging her back to bed and doing the right thing. I'm sorry, I blurt out. That was a mistake. Her eyes widen. It didn't feel like a mistake. You're hardly in any condition to be thinking clearly right now. I knew better, even if you didn't. Marge says that it's normal to crave life when you're in the throes of death. And that was pretty lively. Marge? She runs the grief group. Oh, I sigh. Fabulous. Look, I want you to know that in spite of what you've seen in the few days you've known me, I'm not usually like this. I don't, you know. Right, because you're in love with the married funeral director, I say, rubbing my hand through my hair and making it stand on end. I'd forgotten about him last night, too. That's over, she says. Completely. My head snaps up. You sure? Dead certain, so to speak. She takes a step toward me. Does that make this less of a mistake? No, I say, starting to pace. Because you're still involved in one of my cases. I thought that was over too, since there's no way to identify Joseph anymore as Rainer Hartmann. That's not true. The caveat flies like a red standard in the battlefield of my mind. Without Minka's testimony, the murder of Daria cannot be linked to Rainer Hartmann. But the prisoner wasn't the only one to witness that infraction. Rainer was there too. If someone were to get him to confess to the incident that was written up in his SS file, it would be a slam dunk. There might be another way, I say. But it would mean involving you, Sage. She sits down on the couch, absently stroking the dog's ears. What do you mean? We could wire you up and tape the conversation. Get him to admit that he was reprimanded for killing a Jewish prisoner in a way that wasn't sanctioned. She looks into her lap. I wish you'd asked me first, so that my grandmother never got involved. I'm not going to explain to her that this is a default attempt. It would never have been my first choice. Not just because of the power of a survivor's testimony, but because there's a good reason we don't put civilians into the field as makeshift agents. Particularly ones we might be falling for. I'll do whatever you need me to do, Leo,
Sage says. She gets up and starts unbuttoning her shirt. My shirt. What are you doing?
Honestly? A Harvard degree and you can't figure that out?
No. I take a step backward. Absolutely not. Now you're a material witness.
She winds her arms around my neck. I'll show you my first-hand sources if you show me yours. This girl is going to be the death of me.
With superhuman effort, I push her away. Sage, I can't.
She takes a step back, defeated. Last night, for just a little while, I was happy. Really happy. I can't remember the last time I felt like that. I'm sorry. I love you, but it's an enormous conflict of interest.
Her head snaps up.
You love me?
What?
My face is suddenly on fire.
I never said that.
You did, I heard it.
I said, I'd love to.
No, Sage says, a grin splitting her face. You didn't.
Did I?
I'm so tired I don't know what the hell is coming out of my mouth. Which probably means that I don't have the faculties to cover up what I really feel for Sage Singer, with an intensity that terrifies me.
She places her hands flat on my chest.
What if I tell you that I won't wear the wire unless you come back to bed?
That's blackmail. Sage is beaming. She shrugs. It's easy to say you will do what's right and shun what's wrong, but when you get close enough to any given situation, you realize that there is no black or white. There are gradations of gray. I hesitate, but only for a second. Then I grab Sage around the waist and lift her off her feet. The things I'd do for my country, I say.
It was not easy to break into a prison. First, I had baked the croissant, their bitter almond filling masking the taste of the rat poison I'd mixed in. I left them outside the door where the guard stood, keeping watch over Alex until tomorrow morning. Then, the new captain of the guard, Damien's second in command, would torture him to death. Whistling like a trapped animal, I got the guard to open the door to see about the racket. Finding nothing, he had shrugged and taken in the basket of pastries. A half hour later, he was lying on his side, his mouth foaming in the throes of death. Nobody who looks at a shard of flint lying beneath a rock ledge, or who finds a splintered log by the side of the road would ever find magic in their solitude. But in the right circumstances, if you bring them together, you can start a fire that consumes the world. Yes, now I had killed a man. Surely that meant we belonged together. I would have eagerly rotted in this cell beside Alex if it was all the time I had left with him. Through the cell window, I watched Alex as he sat with his back against the dank wall, eyes closed. He was a skeleton, emaciated after a month of daily torture. It seemed his captors had tired of the game before Alex's body gave out. Now he wasn't just to be toyed with, he was to be murdered. When he heard me approach, he stood. I could see the effort it cost him. You came, he said, twining his fingers with mine through the bars. I got your note. I sent it 2 weeks ago, he said, and it took 2 weeks before that to coax the bird onto the window ledge. I'm so sorry, I said. Alex's hands were scarred and broken from the beatings, yet he still held me tight. Please, he whispered. Do one thing for me tonight. Anything, I promised. Kill me. I drew a deep breath. Alex, I said.
Sage. If you had told me a month ago that I'd be undertaking a covert mission as an FBI field agent, I would have laughed in your face. Then again, if you told me that I would be falling in love with a man other than Adam, I would have told you you were crazy. Leo, without a reminder, asks for soy milk every time we order coffee. He turns the shower on before he leaves the bathroom so that the water is warm before I get in. He holds the door open for me and won't drive anywhere until my seatbelt is fastened. Sometimes there's this expression on his face, as if he cannot quite believe he got so lucky. I'm not sure what he's seeing when he looks at me, but I want to be that girl. And my scars? I still see them when I look in a mirror, but the first thing I notice is my smile. I'm nervous about taping my conversation with Joseph. It's going to happen, finally, after 3 days of waiting. First, my sisters had to end their Shiva calls. Second, Leo needed to secure permission to use electronic surveillance through the DOJ Criminal Division's Office of Enforcement Operations. And third, Joseph had to be discharged from the hospital. I'm going to be the one to bring him home, and then, I hope, I can get him to confess to Daria's murder. Leo has been arranging all the details from my house, where we moved back in as a team after that first night in the hotel. It was by unspoken agreement that we decided he would check out of the Marriott and come and stay with me instead. Although I was ready to fight off my sister's comments and questions, I didn't even have to do any damage control. Leo had had Pepper and Saffron charmed after 10 minutes of conversation about how a famous thriller writer had shadowed him for a film role, taken pages of notes, and then completely ignored reality to create a bestseller that, while wildly inaccurate, had shot to the top of the New York Times list.
"I knew it,"
Saffron had told him. "My book club read it. We all felt there was no way a Russian spy would ever make it into the DOJ with false credentials." "Actually, that's not the biggest stretch, but the main character, the one who has a full closet of Armani suits? No way, not on a government salary," Leo had said. Of course, I couldn't really explain Leo's presence, or Eva's, for that matter, without telling my sisters about Joseph. And to my surprise, that made me an instant celebrity. "I can't believe you're hunting Nazis," Saffron said last night, the last meal we would share before she and Pepper left for the airport in the morning to return to their respective homes. "My little sister." "I'm not really hunting them," I corrected. One sort of fell into my lap. I had called Joseph twice, at Leo's suggestion, and explained my absence with the truth. A close relative had died unexpectedly. I had family business to take care of. I told him Eva missed him. I asked him what the doctors said about his condition, and I arranged the details of his hospital discharge. "Still," Pepper agreed, "Mom and Dad would be delighted, considering all the fuss you made about not going to Hebrew school." "This isn't about religion," I tried to explain. "It's about justice." "They don't have to be mutually exclusive," Leo said amiably. And just like that, he steered the conversation away from a critique of me and to an analysis of the last election. It's an odd luxury, knowing someone's got my back. Unlike Adam, whom I was always defending to others, Leo effortlessly defends me. He knows what will upset me before it even happens, and like a superhero, bends the track of the runaway train before it strikes. This morning, when Pepper and Saffron leave, I have a box of freshly baked chocolate croissants for them as a care package. My sisters hug Leo goodbye. Then I walk them out to the driveway, to the rental car. Pepper embraces me tightly. "Don't let this one get away, Sage. I want to hear how everything turns out. You'll call me?" It is the first time I can remember my sister soliciting contact instead of just criticizing me. "Absolutely, I promise." In the kitchen, Leo is just hanging up the phone when I return. "We can pick up the van on the way to the hospital. Then while you're getting Joseph..." "Sage, what's wrong?" "For starters," I say, "I'm not used to getting along with my sisters." "You made them out to be Scylla and Charybdis," Leo says, laughing. "They're just ordinary moms." "It's easy for you to say. They're mesmerized by you." "I hear I have that effect on singer women." "Good," I reply. "Then maybe you can use that magic to hypnotize me so that I don't screw this up today." He comes around the counter and rubs my shoulders. "You're not going to screw this up. You want to go over it again? I nod. We have done dry runs of this interview a half dozen times, some with the recording equipment to make sure it works properly. Leo has played the role of Joseph. Sometimes he's forthcoming, sometimes he is belligerent. Sometimes he just shuts down and refuses to talk. I say that I'm losing courage, that if I'm going to bite the bullet and actually kill him, I need to be able to think about what he did as a concrete example, not a global genocide, that I need to see a face or hear a name of one of his victims. In every scenario so far, I've gotten him to confess. Then again, Leo is not Joseph. I take a deep breath. I ask him how he feels. Right, or anything else that seems natural. What you don't want is for him to think you're nervous. Great. Leo sits down on the stool beside mine. You want him to open up without leading him on. What do I say about my grandmother? He hesitates. Normally, I'd tell you not to bring Minka up at all, but you did mention a death in the family, so play it by ear. If you do mention her, though, don't let on that she's the grandmother who was the survivor. I just can't be certain how he'll read that. I bury my face in my hands. Can't you just interrogate him? Sure, Leo says. But I'm pretty sure he'll know something's up when I show up at the hospital instead of you. The plan is for Leo to be parked in a van across the street from Joseph's house. That way the receiver, a box the size of a small briefcase, will be in range for the transmitter of the body wire. While Leo is hidden in the van doing surveillance, I will be in Joseph's house. We have a safe word, too. And if I say, I'm supposed to meet Mary today, then I run in and draw my gun, but I can't get a clear shot without hitting you, so instead I break out the jiu-jitsu moves that got me a blue ribbon in 7th grade. I toss Joseph off you like a cheap coat and pin him against the wall by the neck. I say, don't make me do something we'll both regret, which sounds like a movie line, and is, but I've used those before in tense law enforcement situations, and they actually work. I release Joseph, who collapses to my feet, and confesses not just to all war crimes at Auschwitz, but also for being responsible for the colossal mistakes, New Coke, and Sex and the City 2. He signs on the dotted line, we call in local law enforcement for an arrest, and you and I ride off into the sunset. I shake my head, smiling. Leo actually does carry a gun, but he's assured me that ever since Camp Whakatane in 5th grade, any weapon is really for show, that he could not hit a target the size of Australia. It's hard to tell with him, but I imagine he's lying. I cannot imagine that the DOJ lets him carry a weapon without having learned how to use it efficiently. Leo looks at his watch. We should get going. You ready to get suited up? It's hard to wear a wire when it's summertime. My usual outfit, a tank top and jean shorts, is too tight to hide the microphone that will be taped underneath my shirt. Instead, I have opted for a loose sundress. Leo hands me the transmitter. It's the size of an iPod mini, with a small hook that can be affixed to a waistband or belt, neither of which I have. Where am I supposed to put it? He pulls aside the neck of the dress and tucks the transmitter into the side of my bra. How's that? So comfortable, I say. Not. You sound like you're 13. He threads the wire with the tiny microphone under my arm and around my waist. I pull down the top of the sundress so that he has better access. What are you doing? Leo says, backing away. Making it easier for you? He swallows. Maybe you should do it. Why are you so shy all of a sudden? Isn't that like locking the barn door after the horses are gone? I'm not shy, Leo grits out. I'm trying very hard to get us to the hospital on time, and this doesn't help. Can you just, you know, tape it down and pull up your damn dress? When the microphone and transmitter are in place, we make sure the channels are synced to the receiver that Leo will have in the van. I'm driving the rental car. Leo sits in the passenger seat with the receiver on his lap. We go first to Joseph's house, where we drop off Eva and test the transmitter for distance. It works, Leo says, when I get back in the car, having filled Eva's water bowl and spread her toys around the living room, promising her that Joseph is on his way. I follow the GPS directions to the parking lot where Leo is meeting someone from the DOJ. He is quiet, running through checklists in his mind. The only other car there is a van, making me wonder how the other officer will get back home. It's blue and says Don's Carpets on the side. A man gets out of the driver's side and flashes his badge. Leo Stein? Yep, Leo says through the open window. Just a sec. He hits the power button so that the window rolls up again, so that our conversation is private. Don't forget to make sure that there's no background interference, Leo says. I know. So if he likes to listen to CNN or NPR, make sure you turn it off. Power down your cell. Don't grind coffee beans. Don't use anything that could affect the transmission. I nod. Remember that why isn't a leading question. Leo, I say, I can't remember all this stuff. I'm not a professional. He mulls for a moment. You just need a little inspiration. You know what J. Edgar Hoover would do if he were alive today? I shake my head. Scream and claw at the top of his coffin. The response is so unexpected, so irreverent, that a bark of laughter escapes before I can cover my mouth. I can't believe you're making jokes while I'm freaking out. Isn't that exactly when you need them? Leo asks. He leans forward and stamps me with a kiss. Your gut instinct was to laugh. Go with your gut, Sage. As the doctor relays the post-discharge instructions to us, I wonder if Joseph is thinking the same thing I am, that a dead man, which he hopes to be, does not have to worry about salt intake or rest or anything else on the printout we are given. The candy striper who wheels Joseph down to the lobby so I can bring my car around recognizes him. Herr Weber, right? She asks. My older brother had you for German. Wie heißt er? She smiles shyly. I took French. I asked for his name. Jackson, the girl says. Jackson O'Rourke? Oh, yes, Joseph says. He was an excellent student. When we reach the lobby, I take over and wheel Joseph to a spot in the shade outside. Did you really remember her brother? Not one bit, he admits, but she didn't need to know that. I'm still thinking about this exchange when I reach Leo's car in the parking lot and drive it under the portico so that Joseph doesn't have to walk as far. What made Joseph such a memorable teacher and such a devoted citizen was his ability to make these connections with individuals, to hide in plain sight. In retrospect, it's been a brilliant plan. When you look someone in the eye and shake his hand and tell him your name, he has no reason to think you are lying. This is a new car, Joseph says, as I help him into the passenger seat. It's a rental. Mine's in the shop. I totaled it. An accident? You are all right? He asks. I'm fine. I hit a deer. Your car and your relative passing. So much has happened in the past week that I do not know about. He folds his hands in his lap. I am sorry to hear of your loss. Thank you, I say stiffly. What I want to say is, the woman who died was my grandmother. You knew her. You don't even remember, probably. You son of a bitch. Instead, I keep my eyes on the road as my hands flex on the steering wheel. I think we need to talk, Joseph says. I slide a glance toward him. All right. About how and when you are going to do it. Sweat begins to run down my back, even though the air conditioner is on full blast. I can't talk about this now. Leo isn't close enough with the receiver to record the conversation. So instead I do exactly what he told me not to do. I turn to Joseph. You said you knew my mother. Yes. I should not have kept this a secret. I'd say that little white lie is the least of your problems, Joseph. I slow at a yellow light. You knew my grandmother was a survivor. Yes, he says. Were you looking for her? He looks out the window. I did not know any of them by name. I sit at the red light long after it turns green, until a car behind me honks, thinking that he has not really answered my question. When we pull up to Joseph's house, the carpet van is exactly where it's supposed to be, across the street. I can't see Leo. He's somewhere in the cavernous back with his receiver ready and waiting. I help Joseph up the porch stairs, giving him an arm to lean on when he can't bear his own weight. Leo, I'm sure, is watching. In spite of his earlier superhero story, I know he's ready to rescue me if necessary, and he doesn't find it unreasonable to think an elderly man who can barely walk is capable of doing harm. An 85-year-old subject once came out of his house and started shooting, he told me, but luckily he had cataracts and lousy aim. We have a saying in our office, Leo had said. Once you've killed 6 million, what's 6 million and 1? As soon as the key turns in the lock, Eva comes running to greet her master. I lift her squirrely little body and place her in Joseph's arms so that she can lick his face. His smile is as wide as the sea. Oh, mein Schatz, I missed you, Joseph says. I realize, watching the reunion, that this is the perfect relationship for him. Someone who loves him unconditionally, who has no conception of the monster he used to be, and who can listen to any tearful confessions without ever betraying his confidence. Come, Joseph announces. I will make us tea. I follow him into the kitchen, where he sees the fresh fruit on the counter and then opens the refrigerator to find milk, juice, eggs, and bread. You did not have to do this, Joseph says. I know, but I wanted to. No, he corrects. I mean, you did not have to. If, that is, I was willing to kill him any time soon. Here goes nothing, I think. Joseph. I pull out a chair and gesture for him to sit down. We have to talk. You are not having second thoughts, I hope. I sink down across from him. How could I not? I hear the drone of a lawnmower outside. The kitchen windows are open. Shit. I fake an enormous sneeze. Standing up, I walk around and start ratcheting the windows shut. I hope you don't mind. The pollen's killing me. Joseph frowns, but he is too polite to complain. I'm afraid of what will happen after, I admit. No one suspects foul play when a 95-year-old man dies. Joseph chuckles. And there is no one left behind in my family to ask questions. I'm not talking about the legal aspect, just the moral one. I find myself fidgeting and force myself to stop, thinking of the rustling of the fabric that Leo must be hearing. I feel a little silly having to ask you this, but you're the only person I would know who might even understand, because you've been there. I look up at him. When you kill someone, how do you ever get over it? I've asked you to help me die, Joseph clarifies. There's a difference. Is there? He exhales heavily. Maybe not, he admits. You will think of it every day, but I would hope you could see it as mercy. Is that how you thought of it? I ask, the most natural flow, and then I hold my breath for his answer. Sometimes, Joseph says, they were so weak, some of them. They wanted to be released, like I do now. Maybe that's just what you told yourself so you could sleep at night. I lean forward, my elbows on the kitchen table. If you really want me to forgive you for what you've done, you have to tell me all of it. He shakes his head, his eyes growing damp. I have already. You know what I was. What I am. What was the worst thing you did, Joseph? It strikes me as I ask the question that we are gambling. Just because Daria's murder was the one written up does not mean it was the most heinous crime Reiner Hartmann committed against a prisoner. It only means that it was the one where he got caught. There were two girls, he says. One of them worked for my brother in his office, where he kept a safe with the currency that was taken from the prisoner's belongings. He rubs his temples. We all did it, you know, took things. Jewelry or money, even loose diamonds. Some officers, they got rich working in the camps for this reason. I listened to the news. I knew that the Reich was not going to last much longer now that the Americans had gotten involved. So I planned ahead. I would take what money I could, and I would convert it to gold before it was worthless. Shrugging, Joseph looks at me. It was not hard to get the combination to the safe. I was the SS Schutzhaftlagerführer, after all. There was only the commandant above me, and when I asked for something, the question was not whether I would get it, but how quickly. So one day, when I knew my brother was not at his desk, I went to the safe to take what I could. The girl, the secretary, saw me. She had fetched her friend from her job outside and brought her to the office while my brother was gone to warm up, I suppose, he says. I could not let the girl tell my brother what she had seen. So I shot her. I realize I'm holding my breath. You shot the girl who was the secretary? I meant to. But I had been injured, yes, on the front line. My right arm. I was not as steady with the pistol as I should have been. The girls were moving, frantic. They were clutching at each other. So the bullet went into the other girl instead.
You killed her?
Yes. He nods. And I would have killed the other one, too, but my brother arrived first. Then he saw me there, with the gun in one hand and the money in the other. What choice did I have? I told him that I had caught the girl stealing from him, from the Reich. Joseph covers his eyes with one hand. His throat works, the words jamming. My own brother did not believe me. My own brother turned me in.
Turned you in?
To the disciplinary committee at the camp. Not for stealing, but for shooting a prisoner against protocol, he says. It was nothing, a simple meeting where I was reminded of my orders. But you see, don't you? Because of what I did, my own brother betrayed me. I'm not sure what element of this story makes it, in Joseph's warped mind, the worst thing he ever did. That he murdered Daria, or that he destroyed the relationship he had with his brother. I am afraid to ask. I'm more afraid to hear the answer. What happened to your brother?
I never talked to him again after that. I heard he died a long time ago.
Joseph is crying silently, his hands trembling where they rest on the table.
Please, he begs. Will you forgive me?
What will that change? It won't bring back the girl you killed. It won't fix what happened with your brother.
No, but it means that at least one person will know. I wish it had never happened.
I'll think about it, I reply.
I get into the rental car and blast the air conditioning. At the end of Joseph's block, I turn right into a cul-de-sac and pull over at the curb. Leo is driving toward me in the van. He swerves so fast that the van goes over the curb, then hops out and pulls me out of the car and twirls me in a circle.
You did it,
he crows, punctuating each word with a kiss.
God damn, Sage, I couldn't have done a smoother job.
Are you hiring? I ask. Relaxing for the first time in 2 hours.
Depends on what position you're looking for.
Leo frowns.
Wow, that came out wrong. Come here.
He opens the back of the van and rewinds the digital recorder so that I can hear my own voice and Joseph's.
You killed her.
Yes, and I would have killed the other one, too.
So it's done, I say.
My voice sounds hollow, with none of the bright ring to it that Leo's has. He'll be deported?
There's just one more step, I already called Ginevra, my historian, and she's headed here tonight. Now that we've got Joseph on tape confessing, we'll see if he's willing to cooperate and talk to us voluntarily. We drop in unannounced, usually to see if the subject has an alibi, but clearly that's not the case here. It's just a way for us to get even more information, if that's possible, to secure the case. Then Ginevra and I head back to D.C. Back? I echo. I need to write a prose memo so that the Deputy Assistant Attorney General can approve it, start legal proceedings, and issue a press release. And then, I promise you, Joseph Weber will die, he says. Miserably. In prison. Ginevra the historian is arriving in Boston rather than Manchester, because that was the quickest flight she could book. That means a 5-hour round-trip drive for Leo, but he says he doesn't mind. He will use the time to fill her in on the aspects of the case that she's missed. I stand behind him, watching him knot his tie in the bathroom mirror. Then, Leo says, I will drop her off at the courtyard. From what I understand, the beds are pretty comfortable. Are you going to stay there too? He pauses. Did you want me to? In the mirror, we look like a modern American Gothic. I thought you might not want your historian to know about me. He folds me into his arms. I want her to know everything about you. From the way you're the consummate double agent to the way you rock out to John Mellencamp in the shower and sing all the wrong words. They're not the wrong... It's not you pull off those Barbie books, trust me on this. Besides, Ginevra's going to get to know you when we go out after work in the district. It takes me a moment before the words sink in. I don't live in the district. Technicality, Leo says shyly. We have bakeries in D.C. It just doesn't feel right, Leo. You're having second thoughts? He freezes. I come on strong. 140%. I know that. But I just found you, Sage. I don't want to let you go. It can't be a bad thing to know what you want and run with it. One day, years from now, we can read the press release about Reiner Hartmann aloud to our babies and tell them that Mommy and Daddy fell in love because of a war criminal. He looks at my face and winces. Still too over the top? I wasn't talking about moving, although that's still up for discussion. Tell you what, if you can find a Department of Justice job up here, I'll move. It's Joseph, I interrupt. It just doesn't feel right. Leo takes my hand and leads me out of the bathroom, sits me on the edge of the bed. This is harder for you than it is for me, because you knew him as someone else before you knew him as Reiner Hartmann. But this is what you wanted, isn't it? I close my eyes. I can't remember anymore. Then let me help you out. If Reiner Hartmann is deported or even extradited, it's going to be news. Big news. Everyone will hear it. Not just in our country, but all over the world. I'd like to think that maybe the next person who's about to do something horrific, the soldier who's given an order to commit a crime against humanity, will remember that press release about the Nazi who was caught, even at age 95. Maybe in that moment he'll realize that if he carries out his order, the United States government or some other one is going to hunt him down for the rest of his life, too, no matter how far he runs. And maybe he'll think, I'm going to have to be looking over my shoulder forever, like Reiner Hartmann. So instead of doing what he's been told to do, he'll say no. Doesn't it count for anything if Joseph wishes he hadn't done it? Leo looks at me. What counts, he says, is that he did. Mary is in the Shrine Grotto when I arrive. I'm a sticky mess. The air is so humid that it seems to be condensing through my skin. I feel like I've replaced all my hemoglobin with caffeine. I'm that jittery. I have a lot to do before Leo gets back tonight. Thank God you're here, I say, as soon as I reach the top of the holy stairs. That means a lot, coming from an atheist, Mary says. She is silhouetted against the dusk, in the kind of light that would make a painter swoon, fingers of purple and pink and electric blue, like the salvia she is weeding. I tried to call you to see how you were doing with your grandmother and all, but you don't answer messages anymore. I know, I got it. I've just been really busy. With that guy. How did you know that? I ask. Honey, anyone with two functional brain cells who was at the funeral or the gathering afterward could have figured that out. I have only one question for you about him. She looks up. Is he married? No. Then I already like him. She strips off her gardening gloves and sets them on the edge of the bucket she's using to collect the weeds for composting. So where's the fire? I have a question for a priest, I explain, and you're the closest thing around. I'm not sure if I should be flattered by that or if I should find a new hairstylist. It's about confession. That's a sacrament, Mary replies. Even if I could grant penitence to you, you're not Catholic. It's not like you can sashay into a confessional and wipe your slate clean. It's not me. I was asked to do the forgiving. But the sin, it's truly, truly awful. A mortal sin? I nod. I'm not asking about how confession works for the person who's confessing. I want to know how the priest does it. Here's something he can barely stomach, and then lets it go. Mary sits beside me on the teak bench. By now, the sun has sunk so low that everything on the shrine's hill is glowing and golden. Just looking at it, at so much beauty in one place, makes the tightness in my chest loosen a little. Surely if there's evil in the world, it's counterbalanced by moments like these. You know, Sage, Jesus didn't tell us to forgive everyone. He said turn the other cheek, but only if you were the one who was hit. Even the Lord's Prayer says it loud and clear. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Not others. What Jesus challenges us to do is to let go of the wrong done to you personally, not to the wrong done to someone else. But most Christians incorrectly assume this means that being a good Christian means forgiving all sins and all sinners. What if, even tangentially, the wrong that was done does have something to do with you, or with someone close to you, anyway? Mary folds her arms. I know I've told you how I left the convent, but did I ever tell you why I entered it? She says. My mother was raising three kids on her own because my father walked out on us. I was the oldest, at 13. One day, after listening to the priest give a sermon about forgiveness, I went to see him. I was full of so much anger that sometimes I woke up in the middle of the night with the taste of it in my mouth, like tin. We couldn't afford groceries. We had no television and the lights had been turned off. Our furniture had been reclaimed by the credit card company, and my brothers were wearing pants that hit above the ankle because we couldn't afford to buy new school clothes. My father, though, he was on vacation with his girlfriend in France. So I sat down across from the priest, and I said, "How can you possibly say that I should forgive him?" I study Mary's profile as she speaks. The priest said, "I'm not suggesting you forgive him because what he did was okay. It wasn't. I'm suggesting you forgive him because otherwise he will grow like a weed in your heart until it's choked and overrun. The only person who suffers when you squirrel away all that hate is you." I was 13 and I didn't know very much about the world, but I knew that if there was that much wisdom in religion, I wanted to be a part of it. She faces me. I don't know what this person did to you, and I am not sure I want to. But forgiving isn't something you do for someone else. It's something you do for yourself. It's saying, you don't get to turn me into a victim. You are not important enough to me to be the object of my hate. Once you do that, your enemy stays chained to his past. But you're free. I think of my grandmother, whose silence all these years had accomplished the same goal. For better or for worse, Joseph Weber is part of my life, of my family's story. Is the only way to edit him out of it to do what he's asked, to excuse him for his actions? Does any of that help? Mary asks. Yeah, surprisingly.
She pats my shoulder. Come on down with me. I know a place you can get a good cup of coffee. I think I'm going to stay here for a little bit. Watch the sunset. She looks at the sky. Can't blame you. I watch her move down the holy stairs until I can't see her anymore. It's dusk now, and the edges of my hands look fuzzy. The whole world seems like it's unraveling. I pick up Mary's gardening gloves, which are draped over the edge of the bucket like wilted lilies. I lean over the railing of the Monet garden and cut a few stalks of monkshood. In the pale palm of Mary's glove, the blue-black petals look like stigmata, another sorrow that can't be explained away, no matter how hard you try. There are so many ways to betray someone. You can whisper behind his back. You can deceive him on purpose. You can deliver him into the hands of his enemy when he trusts you. You can break a promise. The question is, if you do any of these things, are you also betraying yourself? I can tell, when Joseph opens the door, that he knows why I've come. Now? He asks, and I nod. He stands for a moment, his hands at his sides, unsure of what he's supposed to do. The living room, I suggest. We sit opposite each other, the chessboard between us, set neatly for a new game. Eva lies down, a donut at his feet.
Will you take her?
He asks. Yes. He nods, his hands folded on his lap.
Do you know how?
I nod and reach for the backpack I've worn while biking here in the dark.
I have to say something first, Joseph confesses. I lied to you.
My hands still on the zipper.
But I told you earlier today. That was not the worst thing I ever did,
Joseph says. I wait for him to continue.
I did speak to my brother again, after. They had not been in contact after the investigation, but one morning he came to me and said we had to run. I assumed he had information that I didn't, so I went with him. It was the Allies. They were liberating the camps, and any officers who were lucky managed to escape instead of being shot by them or killed by the remaining prisoners.
Joseph looks down.
We walked for days, crossing the German border. When we reached the city, we hid in the sewers. When we were in the country, we hid in barns with cattle. We ate garbage just to stay alive. There were those who sympathized with us. Still, and somehow, we managed to get false papers. I said we needed to leave this country as soon as possible, but he wanted to go back home, to see what was left.
His lower lip begins to quiver.
We had picked sour cherries, stealing from a farmer who would never notice the handful missing from his crops. That was our dinner. We were arguing as we ate about which route we would take. And my brother, he started to choke. He fell to the ground, grabbing at his throat, going blue, Joseph says. I stared at him, but I did nothing.
I watch him pass a hand over his eyes, wiping them dry.
I knew it would be easier traveling without him. I knew that he would be more of a burden to me than a blessing. Maybe I had known that my whole life, Joseph says. I have done many things of which I am not proud, but they were during a time of war. The rules don't apply, then. I could excuse them or at least rationalize so that I stayed sane. But this was different. The worst thing I ever did, Sage, was kill my own brother.
You didn't kill him, I say. You chose not to save him.
Is it not the same?
How can I tell him it isn't,
when that's not what I believe. I told you some time ago that I deserve to die. You understand that now? I am a brute, a beast. I killed my own flesh and blood. And that is not even the worst of it. He waits until I meet his gaze. The worst of it, he says coldly, is that I wish I had done it sooner. Listening to him, I realize that no matter what Mary says, what Leo claims, or what Joseph wants, in the end, absolution is not mine to give away. I think about my mother in her hospital bed, pardoning me, of the moment the car spun out of control, when I knew it was going to crash, and I was powerless to stop it. It does not matter who forgives you, if you're the one who can't forget. In the anecdote Leo told me before he left, I realized that I will be the one looking over my shoulder forever. But then again, this man, who helped murder millions, who killed my grandmother's best friend, and who reigned in terror, this man, who had watched his brother choke to death before his eyes, has no remorse. There's an irony to the fact that a girl like me, who's actively struggled against religion her whole life, has turned to biblical justice. An eye for an eye, a death for a death. I unzip the backpack and remove one perfect roll. It has the same intricate crown at the top, the same dusting of sugar as the one I baked for my grandmother. But this one, it's not filled with cinnamon and chocolate. Joseph takes it from my hand. Thank you, he says, his eyes filling with tears. He waits, hopeful. Eat it, I tell him. When he breaks it open, I can see the flecks of monkshood, which has been chopped finely and mixed into the batter. Joseph tears off a quarter of the roll and places it onto his tongue. He chews and swallows, chews and swallows. He does this until the bread is gone. It's his breathing that I notice first, labored and heavy. He starts fighting for air. He slumps forward, knocking several pieces from the chessboard, and I take him in my arms and settle him on the floor. Eva begins to bark, to pull at his pants leg with her teeth. I shoo her away as his arms stiffen, as he writhes before me. To show compassion would elevate me from the monster he was. To show revenge would prove I'm no better. In the end, by using both, I can only hope they will cancel each other out. Joseph, I say, leaning over him and speaking loudly so that I know he hears me. I will never, ever forgive you. In one last desperate effort, Joseph manages to grab my shirt. He bunches the fabric in his fist, pulling me down so that I can smell death on his breath. How does it end? He gasps. Moments later, he stops moving. His eyes roll back. I step over him and retrieve my backpack. Like this, I answer. I take a sleeping pill when I get home, and by the time Leo slips into bed beside me, I am long gone. I'm still groggy, in fact, the next morning when I wake up, which is probably better. Ginevra, the historian, is not at all what I was expecting. She's young, just out of college, and she has a tattoo up one arm that is the entire preamble to the Constitution. It's about time, she says, when she's formally introduced to me. I suck at playing Cupid. We drive to Joseph's in the rental car, with Ginevra sitting in the back seat. I must look like a zombie, because Leo reaches for my hand and squeezes it. You don't have to go in. I had told him yesterday that I wanted to, that I thought Joseph might be more likely to cooperate if he saw me. I may not have to, but I need to. If I was at all worried about Leo thinking I'm acting strange, I shouldn't have been. He is riding on such a high, I'm not sure he even hears me respond.
We pull into Joseph's driveway, and he turns to Ginevra.
Game on, he says.
The point of having her here, he's explained, is so that if Joseph panics and starts fudging details to make himself less culpable, the historian can point out the inaccuracies to the investigator, who can, in turn, call Joseph on his lies. We get out of the car and walk to the front door. Leo knocks. When he opens the door, I'm going to ask him if he's Mr. Weber, Leo told me this morning as we were getting dressed. And when he nods yes, I'll say, but that's not your real name, is it? However, no one answers the door. Ginevra and Leo look at each other. Then he turns to me.
Does he still drive?
No, I say. Not anymore.
Anywhere you think he might be?
He didn't say anything to me, I reply. And this is true. You think he flew the coop? Ginevra asks. Wouldn't be the first time.
Leo shakes his head. I don't think he had any idea she was wearing a wire.
There's a key, I interrupt, in the frog over there. I walk numbly to the corner of the porch where the frog sits in a potted plant. It makes me think of the monk's hood. The key is cold in the palm of my hand. I open the door and let Leo enter first.
Mr. Weber?
He calls, walking through the foyer toward the living room. I close my eyes.
Mr. Oh, shit. Ginevra, call 911.
He drops his briefcase. Joseph is lying exactly the way I left him, in front of the coffee table, chess pieces scattered around him. His skin has a tinge of blue to it. His eyes are still open. I kneel down and grab his hand.
Joseph,
I yell, as if he can hear me.
Joseph, wake up!
Leo holds his fingers to Joseph's neck, feeling for a pulse. He looks at me across Joseph's body.
I'm sorry, Sage.
Another one bites the dust, boss? Ginevra asks, peering over his shoulder.
It happens. It's a race against the clock at this point.
I realize I'm still holding Joseph's hand. Around his wrist is the hospital bracelet that he never removed. Joseph Weber, DOB, 42018. Be positive. Suddenly, I can't breathe. I drop Joseph's hand and back into the foyer where Leo threw down his briefcase when he saw the body lying on the living room floor. Grabbing it, I slip away from the front door just as the local police and EMTs arrive. They start speaking to Ginevra and Leo as I walk down the hall to Joseph's bedroom. I sit on the bed and open the clasp on Leo's briefcase, take out the SS file that he had not let me read just days before. On the first page is the photo of Rainer Hartmann. And addressed in Wavelsburg. The birthday, which was the same as Hitler's, Joseph had once said. And a different blood type. Rainer Hartmann had been AB. This was something that the SS would have known and reflected not only in his file, but also in the Blutgruppe tattoo, the one Joseph said he had carved out with a Swiss Army knife after the war. However, last week, when Joseph had been admitted to the hospital unconscious, phlebotomists had drawn his blood and typed it B positive, which meant Joseph Weber was not Rainer Hartmann after all. I think of my grandmother telling me about the Schutzhaft Lagerführer and the pistol that shook in his right hand. Then I visualize Joseph sitting across from me at our daily bread, holding his fork in his left hand. Had I been too stupid to notice the discrepancies, or had I not wanted to see them? I can still hear voices down the hall. Gingerly, I pull open the nightstand on Joseph's side of the bed. Inside, there is a packet of tissues, a bottle of aspirin, a pencil, and the journal that he always carried with him to our daily bread, the one he had left behind that very first night. I know what I'm going to find before I open it. The small cards, with their scalloped edges, have been carefully taped at the corners to affix them to the page, picture side down. The tiniest, most careful handwriting I recognize with its precipitous spikes and valleys, fills each square. I cannot read the German, but I don't have to in order to know what I've found. I carefully peel the card away from the yellowed paper and turn it over. There's a baby in the photograph. Written in ballpoint pen along the bottom is a name. Anya. Each of the cards is a picture, labeled. Gerda. Herschel. Chaim. The story stops before the version that my grandmother gave me. The version she recreated when she was living here and thought she was safe. Joseph was never Rainer Hartmann. He was Franz. This is why he could not tell me what he did all day long as an SS Schutzhaftlagerführer. He never was one. Every story he had relayed to me was his brother's life, except for the one he'd told yesterday about watching Rainer die before his eyes. The worst of it is that I wish I had done it sooner. The room spins around me, and I lean forward, resting my forehead against my knees. I had killed an innocent man. Not innocent. Franz Hartmann had been an SS officer, too. He might have killed prisoners at Auschwitz, and even if he didn't, he was a cog in a killing machine, and any international war tribunal would hold him accountable. I knew he had beaten my grandmother, as well as others, badly. By his own admission, he had intentionally let his brother die. But did any of this excuse what I had done? Or, like him, was I trying to justify the unjust? Why would Franz have gone to so much trouble to paint himself as the more brutal brother? Was it because he blamed himself as much as his brother for what had happened in Germany? Because he felt responsible for his brother's death? Did he think I wouldn't help him die if I knew who he really was? Would I have? I'm sorry, I whisper now. Maybe it is the forgiveness Franz had been seeking. And maybe it's just the forgiveness I need for killing the wrong man. The book falls off my lap, landing splayed on the floor. As I pick it up, I realize that although the section written by my grandmother ends abruptly, there is more toward the back of the journal. After three blank pages, the writing picks up in English, in more uniform, precise penmanship. In the first ending Franz has created, Anya helps Alex to die. In the second, Alex lives and suffers torture for the rest of eternity. There is one vignette where Alex, nearly drained of his own blood, is resurrected with Anya's and becomes good again. In another, even though she transfuses him back to health, he cannot shake the evil that runs through his veins and he kills her. There are a dozen of these scenarios, each different, as if Franz could not decide on the outcome that fit the best. How does it end? Joseph had asked. Now I realize he lied twice to me yesterday. He knew who my grandmother was. Maybe he had hoped I'd lead him to her. Not to kill her, as Leo has suspected, but for closure. The monster and the girl who could rescue him. Obviously, he was reading his life story into her fiction. It was why he had saved her years ago. It was why, now, he needed to know if he would be redeemed or condemned. And yet, the joke was on him, because my grandmother never finished her story. Not because she didn't know the ending, and not because she did, as Leo had said, and couldn't bear to write it. She had left it blank on purpose, like a postmodern canvas. If you end your story, it's a static work of art, a finite circle. But if you don't, it belongs to anyone's imagination. It stays alive forever. I take the journal and slip it into my bag beside the recreated version. There are footsteps in the hall, and suddenly Leo is standing in the doorway. "There you are," he says. "You okay?" I try to nod, but don't quite succeed. "The police want to talk to you." My mouth goes dry as bone. "I told them you're basically his next of kin," Leo continues, glancing around. "What are you doing in here anyway?" What am I supposed to say to him? to this man who might be the best thing that has ever happened to me, who lives within the narrow boundaries of right and wrong, of justice and deceit. I was checking his nightstand, I stammer. I thought he might have an address book. People we could contact.
Did you find anything?
Leo asks. Fiction comes in all shapes and sizes. Secrets, lies, stories. We all tell them. Sometimes because we hope to entertain. Sometimes because we need to distract. And sometimes because we have to. I look Leo in the eye and shake my head.
The End. You've been listening to The Storyteller by Jodi Picoult, narrated by Jennifer Iketa as the voice of Anya, Mojan Marno as Sage, Fred Berman as Leo, Eduardo Ballerini as Joseph, and Suzanne Torin as Minka. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Lost Wife by Allison Richman, narrated by George Guidel and Suzanne Torin. During the last moments of calm in pre-war Prague, Lenka, a young art student, and Josef, who is studying medicine, fall in love. With the promise of a better future, they marry, only to have their dreams shattered by the Nazi invasion. Like so many others, they are torn apart by the currents of war. In present-day New York, as a successful obstetrician, Josef has never forgotten the wife he believes died in the war. But in the Nazi ghetto of Terezin, Lenka survived, relying on her skills as an artist and the memories of a husband she knew she would never see again. Then, decades later, and thousands of miles away, an unexpected encounter leads to an inescapable glance of recognition, and the realization that Providence has given Lenka and Josef one more chance. From the glamorous years of life in Prague before the occupation to the horrors of Nazi Europe, The Lost Wife explores the power of first love, the resilience of the human spirit, and our capacity to remember. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So visit us at recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.